So I am not going to tell you how to vote. Two reasons, really. First, it would be against the law of separation of church and state. And except for speed limits, I am pretty much a law-abiding citizen. And two, I suspect that for most of you, I would be preaching to the choir anyway. But if anything about the past week of news around the presidential election has shown us, it is how broken the system is and how much it is in need of healing. So although I will not tell you who to vote for, I do want to talk about some of the moral issues that we are dealing with and how to move from brokenness to wholeness. I believe, as you heard in the story this morning, that you cannot help in the healing of others or of the world until you work on your own healing. Last Sunday's sermon by Bethany, our intern, and the Sunday before that, we focused on how the individual can heal. That is not the only kind of healing there is, because clearly we know that brokenness does exist on a community level and not just the individual level. Communities get broken and hopefully healed, but it is not static. There is not one breaking and then one healing. Hopefully we make progress, but progress is not an inoculation against future brokenness. So I cannot really talk about healing without talking about brokenness, and that is not something that we do well. And by we, I mean us UUs in particular. Although really, humans aren't very good about talking about it either. But we UUs, so many of us were not raised in this faith, and so many of us are come-inners. Many of us have found refuge here after being beat up and abused by other churches and other faiths. Sometimes I hear one of us saying things like, "Oh, those Catholics. You know, those priests, they're pretty sick." Referring to the systemic protection of priests who are pedophiles. Or I hear comments about evangelical ministers who are caught womanizing. Often those remarks are said in a way that implies that we are better than them and less broken. And it might surprise you then, especially if you were not raised in this faith, to find out that our denomination has its own history of sexual abuse by clergy. I bring it up now not because I want to inflict more pain or badmouth Unitarian Universalism. This is a faith I love. But I think that it's a good case study on how healing can happen on a systemic level. So let me give you the very short, abbreviated version of this history of our wrongdoings. And it was brought forth especially well by two Berry Street essays. Each year in June, the evening before General Assembly begins, the Unitarian Universalist Ministers Association hosts the Berry Street Essay Lecture. This has been going on like since Channing was a minister, like 170 some odd years. Really long time. It's a very prestigious lecture. It is intended to be primarily for religious leaders, ministers, and educators, but anybody can go. Deborah Lance Pope gave the historical and systemic context for what happened in UU congregations and in our association in her Berry Street essay of 2011. There she outlined some of what happened. The intersection of the free love movement of the 60s and 70s, the sexism alive and kicking among ministers and our congregations at that time, and our natural predilections as UUs to think that we are somehow better than others and do not really need to follow those rules so closely. Now, it's not that ministers did not have affairs with congregants before this time. The plot idea for the Scarlet Letter must have come from somewhere. But in our history, there were ministers who openly joined swinging parties or who had multiple affairs with congregants, and yes, some who abused children. And it seemed to be more apparent at this time in our history. The UUA did not hit the media like the Catholic Church did. But that does not mean that we are without our brokenness, and our response to those who have been victimized in our midst has not always been good. Congregants who had been abused by ministers when they reported to the UUA 20 or even 10 years ago were often not given the support they needed. They were often counseled to keep it quiet. Congregations who knew they had had a minister who had offended would fire the minister and keep it quiet and move on and not want to talk about it. And so offending ministers were able to relocate even without the help of a bishop. This year, Reverend Gail Seavey gave the lecture, and it was entitled, If Our Secrets Define Us. Reverend Seavey's intent, at least one of them, was to open the curtain that hides the system's secrets. She asked, if our secrets define us, then the only thing to do is tell the stories. And she did. And she named names. And there were gasps. It was painful to hear some of these stories, to know that the people were real people, real congregations who had been hurt so deeply by ministers, people they had put their trust in. It was painful to listen to as a minister. These were colleagues of mine. We were not unprepared. The UUMA knew what was coming in this lecture. And in their wisdom, they posted chaplains around the room, available to talk to folks who were upset, who had been triggered, who needed someone to hold their pain. And there were lines with those chaplains. That is a different response than we had 10 or 20 years ago. It is a sign of progress. But why talk about stuff that is so painful? Why open old wounds? To quote Reverend Seavey, we have seen the damage of chaos, teetered on the point of balance, and leaned in towards shalom. We have looked upon the powers at the tipping point, and we lived. The powers are many. I have seen the powers of love, violence, prestige, community, sex, charisma, intelligence, terror, creativity, healing, secrets, and death. I have seen how those powers interact and overlap. I have seen how we mix up one power for another, thinking that sex is prestige or terror is love. I have seen smart people, good people, fail to understand the impact of sexual misconduct, how pervasive and systemic it is, not just among us, but also throughout our culture. For years, the system at the UUA and in many of our congregations has been to protect the privileged instead of the vulnerable. So why talk about this stuff that is so painful? Why open old wounds? Because those wounds have not healed well, and they need to be attended to. And at the Berry Street essay, there was always a responder. Reverend David Pyle was the responder. You may remember him as the regional staff person who led the startup when I first, the startup event when I first started here. One of the things he said was, he started off saying, I'm supposed to write a response, but we shouldn't have a response. We should respond. And he placed it in the area of being a verb and not a noun. And in that, he said, the response I believe we all need to make to the prophetic message that our dear colleague has brought us today is to accept that it is not my ministry or your ministry or their ministry. It is our ministry, our shared ministry to this faith tradition we so lovingly and awkwardly call Unitarian Universalism. We have to change our culture so that it is expected that I am accountable to you for my practice of ministry, and you are accountable to me for your practice of ministry, because it is a shared ministry that is bound to grow larger than just those who are fellowshipped. We have to build the relationships that require us to call each other in and sometimes call each other out, because this ministry, this faith tradition, and the nature of human relationship to the divine and sacred depends on us walking in this practice of ministry together. It is difficult to have the secrets uncovered. It is painful and scary. There is such a thing as functional denial. It is that thing that gets you, keeps you going between the time of the biopsy and when the doctor calls you with the results. But when functional denial turns into rigid secrecy, that changes things. There can be great fear that if the truth is outed, all will fall apart. As a denomination, we are working on healing from our secrets. Sometimes it's one step forward and three steps back, and sometimes it's three steps forward and one step back, and sometimes we just run around in a circle. But as I look at the arc of our history, we are making progress, and we are healing. We now have ethical guidelines for ministers about whether a minister can be in an emotional or sexual relationship with a congregation member. And let me give you the abbreviated version of that one page of my guidelines. Nope, no, nada, yet, no, never, no. We Unitarians, who are known for being kind of loosey-goosey, have one of the most stringent ethical guidelines for our ministers at this point in time. But that was not always so, and it is now. We have a system in place where if you call the UUA and lodge a complaint against a minister, you will be given an advocate who will be with you through that process, supporting you. We recognize that we have some culpability when that relationship is broken, and we need to support the more vulnerable. We regularly talk as professionals about the appropriate use of power and the inappropriate use of power. And we are not hiding this under a rug anymore. And our response is not always perfect, but we are making progress. I know this because I sit on the Ministerial Fellowship Committee, the MFC. That is the committee that authorizes ministers for the UUA. And I sit on the Executive Committee, that part of the committee that hears the complaints and decides who may keep their fellowship and who must drop it. And we take this work seriously. This spring, Reverend Marie Fortune, a pioneer in clergy sexual violence, will lead our next continuing education session. We know it's a complicated issue, and we know the only way to heal is to shine light on the wound, to debride it, and to help create a holding environment where the healing can take place within the context of a healthy relationship. So I started off talking about the election, and then I spent about 1,600 words talking about this part of our history. What for? Because this has been a rougher week than normal in the presidential race, and each day we seem to be hitting a new low about, and we don't know what we are supposed to do with this. How are we supposed to heal? Can't we just stop talking about all of this? Aren't we at risk of tearing this country apart? Tom Jacobs, in his article, Putting Trump in Historical Perspective, wrote this. This is one of the most discouraging elements of this election. Obama's election felt like a pivot in American history. It seemed to indicate a pretty remarkable advancement of racial attitudes. Now the demons have been let out. Perhaps the lesson in this is that the demons are always there. They've just been suppressed or covered up. Now they're being stirred up again. And as much as it is about race, it is also about gender. I'm just back from giving a talk in Alabama. It was the bumper stickers that referenced gender that were so upsetting. Trump that, and the word rhymes with ditch. These were plastered on vehicles driven by aging white men. They perceived their power and authority as slipping just not to elites and minorities, but also to women. You'd like to dismiss this as some last gasp of a generation and a constituency being left behind. Certainly, I'm surrounded by young people, both liberal and conservative, who embrace an inclusive global reality. You'd like to think that truly this is the future, and perhaps it is. But this election has made me more skeptical. And maybe, just maybe, there is a lesson in that. In this time coming up to the election, the 24-hour news cycle is churning out even more so-called news. More and more of it feels to me like our system is breaking, if not broken. But maybe, just maybe, what is really happening is that the secret of its brokenness is being made known. So how can we heal from this? I say, let us take a lesson from our own UU history. First, let's believe women and men when they disclose abuse and assault. Second, let us be part of a safe holding space. On an individual level, that means listening with love to those who have been harmed and trying not to fix them, but to just hold them. It may also mean reaching out to your more conservative friends and saying, this must be really hard for you. It's hard to see who, when somebody is in charge, falls so hard. And that's not what I usually hear us say. And third, maybe we need to be more proactive in creating relationships. Yesterday in the Washington Post, an article was posted there about Derek Black, a young adult who at one point was the rising star in the white supremacist movement. He and his father had a daily radio show where they talked about white supremacy. And David Duke is his godfather. This man is connected to the movement. The article details how Derek lived this life of a white supremacist all through high school and then went on to college. And he at first did not disclose his connections to the movement. But eventually he was outed on a student online message board, and then he became pretty isolated. Most of the students shunned him. But one posted this question to the online forum. Ostracizing Derek won't accomplish anything. We have a chance to be real activists and actually affect one of the leaders of the white supremacy movement in America. This is not an exaggeration. It would be a victory for civil rights. Who is clever enough to think of something we can do to change this guy's mind? And one of the students, Matthew Stevenson, came up with a brilliant plan. He invited Derek over for Shabbat dinner. Imagine, Matthew was the only Orthodox practicing Jew on that campus. He was the only one at his Shabbat dinners who could say the prayers because he was the only one who knew them. And he risked inviting a white supremacist to a Shabbat dinner. It's either a joke or a movie plot. And strangely enough, Derek went. And even though some students had refused to attend the dinner, Derek kept coming back. Matthew reached out and risked a lot. Over time, Derek created relationships with those folks at the dinner, and they had conversations. And he learned things from them, and he learned things in his history classes in college. And eventually, he denounced his connection to the movement, which also meant a break with his family. And you should go read this article, because it's really moving. We need to find a way to heal the divide, not because it's the nice thing to do, but because it's the right thing to do. I don't think placards, debates, or arguments are going to heal this country, but building relationships will. We have a chance to be real activists and to actually affect history. The Black Lives Matter movement and this presidential race have uncovered the racism and sexism that run deep in our country that we would like to ignore. It is demoralizing because really, I thought we had come further than this. The secret's out. That's a good thing. Now we can begin the steps to healing. in a world without end. May